Hi again. Welcome back. Hope you had a great holiday weekend. We are off and rolling. It is already Tuesday as we are one step away from the first day of June, the year 2005. Hard to believe. When you say Hollywood, the word Hollywood, to most of today's young people or their parents, most of them would conjure up in their minds images of a media version of Hollywood. Glitz, glamour, pop, sizzle, which really bears scant resemblance to Hollywood's golden era. For the better part of 60 years, as many of you know, Hollywood was magic, capital M, spinning out more than 500, sometimes 600 motion pictures a year at its peak in the 1930s, 40s, and into the early 50s. Films, or the movies, were it in terms of not only creating escape and fun and thrills and chills and all the rest of it, but in many ways creating America's culture and actually much of our impressions of ourselves as a nation. The stars that lit up the heavens of the great decades of Hollywood were many, and they were indeed, more often than not, what we call now larger-than-life people. They were superstars even before the term was invented. Clark Gable, Errol Flynn, Jack Benny, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Marilyn Monroe, Carol Lombard, and so many, many more. And then, of course, there were the studio chiefs, the moguls, the gods of Hollywood. Harry Cohn at Columbia, Louis B. Mayer at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Jack and Harry Warner at Warner Brothers, the incredible Howard Hughes, Daryl Zanuck, of course. But they, of course, are all long gone from the Hollywood that once was. And yet, believe it or not, there is still one of the luminaries of the great days of Hollywood alive and very much with us. And I am more than fortunate to be able to share some time tonight with him and you, as we're going to spend a little bit of our evening tonight talking about Hollywood that was and some of those amazing people who used to fill our lives and so many lives for so long with magic. His name is Al Teitelbaum, and are you there, Al?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for being here tonight.
Nice to talk to you, Jeff.
Yeah, it's great to speak with you. Now, back in the old days, and let's set environmental issues aside and stay consistent with the times we're going to talk about, because it was an era where furs, mink stoles, and all the rest of them were, I think, probably the most honored status symbol that anyone could have. Is that a fair statement, Al?
I think so. I mean, the motion picture industry at that time was the idea was to show the women as glamorous women, and that helped do it.
When you had a fur and you stepped out, people, I guess, were almost immediately keyed on the kind of fur you had on. I mean, that was a status symbol in and of itself, just the kind of fur you were wearing.
Well, that's true. That's one of the reasons that mink became so important in the fur industry. Actually, the motion picture industry made the fur industry.
It did. Interesting. When did your dad come to Hollywood first?
In 1923. And he opened on Hollywood Boulevard across of the Chinese Theater.
Right across from Grauman's.
Right, uh-huh.
And, wow, I've forgotten when Sid Grauman built the Chinese Theater.
Oh, yeah, well, when my dad opened the store there, the Chinese Theater was not built. The big theater at that time was Sid Grauman's Egyptian Theater.
So your dad opened a furrier business right on Hollywood Boulevard. That took a little bit of chutzpah, didn't it?
The Hollywood in the 20s and the 30s is not the Hollywood Boulevard that you see today. In those years, it was the fashion spot of, actually, one of the fashion spots of the United States. You had all the fine stores on Hollywood Boulevard. It was later when it was just run down after the war.
Right. So all the high-end clothiers, the jewelry makers, everybody, it was like I guess like Rodeo Drive is today.
Well, it would be. Hollywood Boulevard would have been in those years what the Rodeo Drive represents today.
Now, you started out in the fur business working with your dad, I guess.
I worked for my father originally, huh?
How old were you when you started?
Oh, about 17.
was his clientele at that time composed of film people, or did it build up over the years?
Well, it built up. Actually, during the Depression, the only people that had any money were the people in the motion picture industry. Almost every other business was in trouble.
So nobody else could afford to buy them.
And nobody else could afford to buy furs.
Now, that must have been a pretty heady environment for a young 17-year-old Al Teitelbaum to
Well, it was for me, because I was very impressed with some of the people that came into the store. I remember the first time I saw Gloria Swanson come into the store. She had the chauffeur park in front of the store, and it looked to me like her car was 7 blocks long. And she came in. I don't think the Queen of England acts as royally as Gloria Swanson used to. And it was very funny because, I guess about 35 years later, when Paramount did Sunset Boulevard,
right,
I made the things in for her in that motion picture.
And just to jump ahead a little bit for all of you listening, Al Teitelbaum made furs for not only Hollywood stars, but the studio chiefs and all the big shots in the business for a long, long time. And for you film buffs, you probably have seen the end of some of the films that were on screen. You'll see a big credit, and the credit says, Furs by Teitelbaum. And I don't know how many films that appears in. It must be, what, hundreds?
Oh, actually, probably hundreds. In order to see them today, you've got to be up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right. Right, or have a good rental service you can go to.
Well, that was a very important part of our business. The motion picture industry, at that time in the 20s, was just really getting off the ground. And my dad was doing business with the motion picture industry when it first got started. And I was lucky enough to go along with it.
Gloria Swanson, of course, those of you listening who have seen the film Sunset Boulevard, and for those of you who haven't, go out and rent it. Eric von Stroheim played, of course, her valet, her manservant. And one wonders, she must have had a chauffeur, of course, for that car when they pulled up in front of the store.
She sure did. A uniformed chauffeur.
People in Hollywood, in the film business in the 20s and 30s, it was a community. It was a small town, basically, in some respects, and people would drive around and they would see each other. It wasn't being overrun with tourists back in the 20s and early 30s, was it?
No, it was a different, the environment was entirely different. You had, for example, at the Will Rogers Ranch, you had polo games going on almost every other week. And you would have half the people in Hollywood, they're watching the polo game.
Will Rogers Ranch was, I guess, in Santa Monica, right near the ocean, wasn't it?
Right, okay.
On the west side. So the store was how big?
Well, originally it was one store, and then as things progressed and business got better, my dad took the store next door, tore through the wall, and built a large store.
As a youngster, were you actually at work making the furs themselves?
Well, what my dad did, he wanted me to learn how to fit, and actually that's how I developed into a fur designer.
Mm-hmm.
I took fitting lessons to be able to fit to different customers, you know?
You would work with somebody like a Gloria Swanson? I mean, you'd actually do the tape measuring and all of that?
No, I didn't. At those years, mm-hmm. I didn't. I was too young, actually. My dad did that.
You probably would have been too nervous, too.
that's very true. I remember Gloria Swanson. I also remember Mae Murray and Theda Bara. And in those years, those were the important stars.
They were big. And they transitioned from the silence to the talkies, I guess. Those were the successful ones.
Well, I remember when Al Jolson made the jazz singer.
The first one. Hold on now right there, Al. We have to pause just for a couple minutes. We'll come right back. It's a very rare treat tonight to be able to talk to Mr. Al Teitelbaum, who lived through the great years of Hollywood and has so much to talk about. We'll be right back in just a minute. Don't go away. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along this evening. Back in two. Okay, welcome back. We're talking with Al Teitelbaum, who made the most beautiful furs for the most beautiful people in Hollywood film history for a long time. Okay, Al Jolson made the first talkie, and it wasn't even a full talkie. There were just portions of it that had Al singing in it, I guess, Al. Isn't that the way it went?
That's correct. But it was the beginning. After that, everybody else got into the act. It was very funny, too, because Harry Warner thought it was ridiculous to have sound in them. If I remember correctly, he made a statement saying that who wants to hear an actor talk? But that changed very, very fast.
Yeah, I'll bet. Harry Warner and Jack Warner. Yeah. I want to go back to Gloria Swanson just for a minute, because I have seen her in some beautiful woman as a younger actress, and of course regal as she could possibly be in Sunset Boulevard, if not downright scary. Was she that way in real life to a degree? Did she carry herself like that in public?
She really did. I mean, I don't know if the word royal, you know, is the correct word for it, but she acted as though she was a member of royalty.
Uh-huh. When she came into the store and you were there and listening and all of that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, tell her, what was it? It's a long time ago, but do you remember anything specific? Did she say, I want a mink or a fox? What was it that she got?
Well, at the beginning, that was before mink really became the fashionable fur.
Uh-huh.
Foxes were the main item at that time.
Brown fox, silver fox, I guess several different kinds.
White fox, blue fox.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad also came up with the idea of taking white foxes and dyeing them in pink and green and blue and so forth.
Really?
And the various motion picture designers they did a lot of fur trimming on various outfits that they made to make them more look more regal.
Like
more
cuffs,
important.
Cuffs and what? Collars and things like that?
Oh, yeah. Collars and also borders on long robes and so forth.
I cannot imagine a pink or a green dyed fox.
Well, it was very funny, too, because originally they would have the green or pink or blue, and the motion pictures were not in color yet.
Yeah, I was thinking that. And yet when they'd, I guess, wear them out, they'd be, well, it was attention-getting time.
That was the general idea.
How funny.
And the first fox were very important. Ermine was very important. Ermine and Sable were the regal furs at the time, especially Ermine. That's why when you look at some of the old shots that you saw of people in the 20s and early 30s,
mm-hmm.
you saw at the openings of the various motion pictures, you'd see all the women in their Ermine wraps.
Well, when they come to the premiere and of course the cordon of fans on both sides, and they'd make the walk up to the theater, they'd get out of their limousines, and I've seen so many pictures, they'd have furs, so that would have been Ermine for the most part.
Yeah, all the women wore furs in those years. That was necessary.
When you talk about black and white films, we have to remember that, again, the color of the furs didn't show, and I thought that was odd. Now, who paid for all these? I guess the studios did.
The studios paid for them.
So this
well, you know,
considered...
the studios handled everything differently in those years. It was an entirely different industry, and the attitude of the studios towards the performers was entirely different. In other words, if they picked you out of a group to sign you up, they would give you dancing lessons. They would teach you how to talk, how to act, how to go out in public. In those years, none of the motion picture stars would think of going out in public like they do today, in jeans and so forth. It was taboo. Both the men and the women had to look like movie stars when they were out in the public.
So when you signed a contract, they literally took you in and taught you how to act as a star.
They really did. They taught you how to act and how to, both on the screen and off the screen.
And in some ways, I guess, off the screen behavior was just about as important as on screen, because they did have star and film magazines of sorts back then, and it was, they had the gossip columnists and Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons and Walter Winchell and others before them, of course.
Well,
and
not only that, but they also watched that, that your conduct outside the screen also had to be good. In other words, the easiest way to get the bounced off of contract, almost every contract that they signed had a clause in it that of the way you had to act. If you got into trouble because of some of your actions, you got drunk or took drugs or other things like that, you would get fired.
And some did run into trouble.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, a lot of them did. What people don't understand now, and I don't mean to get into the senior side of things, but alcohol was an incredibly powerful issue on the social scene back then, I understand. And it wasn't the only drug, and alcohol is a drug, of course. It wasn't the only drug that was used by Hollywood stars and others in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
That's true, but it was primarily alcohol.
Mm-hmm. And alcoholism claimed a lot of stars.
That I know.
It led to the ruin of many, many careers. We're talking to Al Teitelbaum, the Furrier to the Stars, and we'll continue our conversation with Al in just a few minutes. Okay, and we're back talking with Al Teitelbaum. And Al had a little anecdote about Al Jolson. Al, go ahead.
Well, actually, when he made the first talkie, you know, it was actually just one. He just sang a song in it.
One song only.
Yeah, and the, you know, when it was advertised, it was just saying that Al Jolson talks, you know, or Al Jolson sings. And uh-huh. That's the way they advertised it.
Oh.
And
so it wasn't advertised as a talking motion picture. It was just Al Jolson sings.
Right, because Al Jolson at that time was a very big Broadway star.
Mm-hmm.
And he was brought out. In fact, in the early years, Hollywood brought a lot of well-known actors from the New York stage and also from the London stage when talkies first started, because they knew that those people could talk. Because unfortunately, some of the big stars, like John Gilbert, just had a very bad voice. It just didn't register. And, a lot of careers were ruined when they started the talkies. So Hollywood started importing, different actors that they knew could come off well, you know, as far as their speaking roles.
Classically trained.
Right.
One that comes to mind, oddly enough, would be someone like Bela Lugosi, who was classically trained and spoke beautifully, even though he had a rather thick accent. But you're right, there were so many. And that John Gilbert story is one that everyone who studies Hollywood film history knows about. But in reality, later on, he came back and did make some talkies after he was pretty much washed up, as I remember it, and his voice wasn't all that bad at all. It was a little high, but...
It was very high-pitched, actually.
Nowadays, they could fix that, of course.
Well, you know, you have to remember, too, that the motion picture industry with the sound system has changed entirely different, too.
Right.
I mean, you can have a singer sing today, and he hits a bad note. And what they can do is later have him sing just that one or two notes before and after, mm-hmm. and then cut that one bad right. note out and put the good note in and splice it, and you'll never know the difference.
And sometimes the actor seen singing today isn't doing the singing.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Totally lip synced.
Yeah.
Now, the business of making films then was truly an industry, but as I said earlier in the program, it was responsible for setting, like today's media, but I think even more so, the tone of America. It had an incredibly powerful influence on America because Americans had no television. They went into the movie houses in unbelievable numbers in terms of percentages. And they saw films which, in their minds, reflected reality to a large degree.
Well, it also showed what was available to the whole world that a lot of people had never even known existed. It showed a way of life that everybody suddenly wanted to take, to be part of.
And what many of the women wanted, of course, was not only to come to Hollywood, but to have their own fur. So your dad was in the right business. So you progressed and learned the business. And when did you actually start doing the designing and fitting and so forth?
That was in, probably 38 or 39.
Mm-hmm.
The motion picture at that time took off on a different tact. They started making motion pictures that were more realistic. I mean, you have to remember when they first started, I remember Charlie Chaplin shooting on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right on Hollywood Boulevard.
Right on Hollywood Boulevard. And the studio was actually at that time just on Highland, just off of Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Hollywood, and it was on Highland and Sunset. And he was a customer of my father's. And then later, Paulette Goddard became my customer.
He was married to Paulette Goddard, right?
I beg your pardon?
Was he married to Paulette Goddard?
I think so.
At one time. Now, what kind of a guy was Chaplin?
I don't know how to put it there. When you talk to him, sometimes you had the idea that he was talking to you and thinking about something else.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question, though, he was incredibly talented.
Some years ago, they found some reels of film that he had taken. He apparently mounted a camera on a truck or a car and just literally drove all around Hollywood, filming the streets and the studios from the outside and what it was like back then. And I don't know if you've ever seen that, but I did, and it was like time travel. It was amazing. He actually recorded a period of American history that no one else thought to do.
Well, he was a very bright man. You had some very talented people in those years, you know? Not that you don't have some of them today, too.
But it wasn't... Today, it all seems to be people on the make, on the hustle, and it's the big... Everything is the deal. The deal. What was it like back then? I know the ethics of today's Hollywood couldn't be any worse, according to everyone I know in the business. They despise it. I once interviewed Joan Fontaine. Oh, this is 15, 20 years ago. And asked her how it was today, and she was just, she said it's horrible, just horrible, compared to what it was. What was it like back then?
Well, I think it was better in those years.
Well, she would agree with you.
I really do. The, number one, you had people who, worked very hard at their craft. They took a great deal of pleasure in doing a good job. Today, the only thing that seems to drive anybody today is money. I mean, of course, some of the salaries that some of the actors and actresses get, it's beyond anything that I can possibly remember. I mean, you pay somebody $30 or $40 million or $20 million to make a motion picture. In those years, that $20 million would have made 25 motion pictures.
Yeah, and I mentioned they used to make, in Hollywood, 500 films a year was not at all unusual. Now they make a tenth of that on a good year.
And the problem is, too, that they make a motion picture and somebody becomes an overnight success and you never hear of them again. And the reason for it is they have not been trained at their craft. They really are not fine actors. You get a lot of people you on there who the publicity has built them up to as though they're big important stars,
mm-hmm.
and you never see them again.
Right, it's true. We call that flash in the pan, I think. And it boils down to the simple fact, that most American actors can't act. They don't have much talent. What they are, as you well know and can observe, they are product. That's what it is.
Well, they've been published. The publicity builds them up to something that they're really not.
Right. It's true. Stand by, if you would, Al. We'll pause and come right back. Jeff Rentz here tonight, spending some time with Mr. Al Teitelbaum. I'll be right back. Okay, and we're back talking to Mr. Al Teitelbaum, whose father and then Al himself ran the business that became known as the Furrier to the Stars in the 30s and 40s and 50s in Hollywood. You had a birthday not too long ago, Al. We don't need to tell everyone how old you are. That's your business. But it
look,
was.
I'm just delighted to still be here at the age of 90.
Well, we're delighted you're here, too. You told me something that was kind of poignant. That your family wanted to invite some people, special people, to come to your birthday party. And folks you had worked with and known and all that. And remember what you told me?
I sure do. It's sad. But we went through an old telephone book that my late wife and I had of all our close friends and also people I'd done business with. And we went over page by page by page. And there wasn't a one of them that was still alive. And it made me wonder, how come I'm still here?
Well, the last man from the great age of Hollywood. Remarkable. Well, happy birthday anyway, my friend.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. The business of Furrier to the Stars, you work with the studios, you work with the set designers, I guess, the costume designers and all that, and people don't understand today how important it is for a film to have a great and talented costume. Who were some of the greats you worked with?
Well, originally, there was Adrian at MGM. Later on, you had Irene there, and then Helen Rose at Paramount. You had Travis Banton. You had Columbia, you had Jean-Louis, who was, I thought, one of the most talented designers in Hollywood.
I've heard of him, yes.
You had Travis Banton, you had Ori Kelly, Milo Anderson, Howard Shoup.
You had
tremendous, people with tremendous ability. Mm-hmm. You know, what people don't realize is that, for example, the way a person was dressed, determined the way they looked on the screen. In other words, you could show a woman or a man looking like a bum or like a very, very rich person. They could look like they were in the height of society, or they could look like a gangster.
And those images were so powerful, too, on the screen back then, because everyone was looking at something 30 feet tall, not on a 30-inch television. I mean, these were huge. The detail must have been amazing.
And detail was amazing. The amount of work that would go on into designing what they were to wear was incredible.
Because every little seam, every little angle had to be just right. And I guess the cinematographers, they're very gifted and talented now, but they were different. They were almost, what were they like? Almost like great portrait photographers, although it was motion picture, because they had to get the lighting right, and it was an incredibly different.
It was a different industry. You have to remember too, they were feeling their way. They didn't have the equipment that they have today that can cover up a lot of mistakes. So whatever they did had to be done properly, and a lot of funny things would happen with costumes. You know, I remember when we made the mink coat look for Orson Welles and Citizen Kane. The amount of photographs they took, the still photographs and so forth, and when you saw it on the screen, all you could see was this big man wearing this great big coat. You couldn't tell what in the world it was, and you wondered, why in the world did we spend two or three weeks figuring it out how to make it, you know?
Well, they had Orson, you mean, take wardrobe shot after wardrobe shot to...
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Well, the picture was very important at that time. Because I had never met Orson Welles until that time. He was a tremendously gifted man. And a lot of things that he did in the motion pictures that he made are standard today, but they were completely new at that time.
Nice fellow.
I thought so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His whole crew, he had brought the group from New York that had worked with him on the radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
And most of those were in his motion pictures. And I remember we had a fitting when he was doing two movies at one time. And he acted in one in the daytime. And then he was directing this other one, I think it was Journey into Fear, if I remember rightly. And we had a fitting there, and I remember one night we got to the studio, and it must have been 7 or 8 o'clock, and he said to me and the other wardrobe man, have you guys had dinner? And we said, no, not yet, we'll eat later. He said, no, he said, we're going to fix dinner here. So they had a little barbecue thing in the studio,
mm-hmm.
on the set there, and he was cooking steaks for everybody and talking about the radio show in New York and so forth. And I thought, my God, how much is this dinner, the time that they spent there, costing RKO? The dinner probably cost $150,000 in time.
There's a Howard Hughes bill, I guess.
Howard Hughes was something special there.
Well, we've got the movie out now. Of course, everyone's seen it, or most everyone, called The Aviator. And we might mention that someone very special had a big role in that thing.
Yes, my grandson played the part of the engineer that worked with him in the, you know, with Howard Hughes, with the part that Howard Hughes played,
uh-huh.
in making the Spruce Goose and the other airplanes that Howard Hughes was making.
Right.
Well, he was a remarkable man. To me, it was incredible when I saw later on or heard all the things that had happened to Howard Hughes at the time he died and so forth. It just seemed inconceivable that this was the same man that I knew, because the Howard Hughes I knew was a very bright, extremely bright man.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice man.
When was the first time you saw him? You remember?
The first time I saw him was we had the store on Hollywood Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Later, of course, when I moved to Beverly Hills on Rodeo Drive, actually, through all the years, even though I did a tremendous amount of business with him, I really only saw him 3 times in person.
So he was rather secretive even back then.
Oh, I mean, it was incredible. In fact, I'll tell you, it was very funny, too, because I knew the people, his attorneys and the other people that he worked with at the studios.
Mm-hmm.
And it was incredible to me that certain people that worked for him for 10 and 15 years had no contact with the other people that were working for him. They didn't know what they were doing. I mean,
everyone compartmentalized.
He did.
Huh. So when you did see him, you saw him 3 times. And let me say this. Now, we're coming up on a break here in a couple of minutes, but we're going to talk more about Howard Hughes after the top of the hour news break. But there's an old expression, if you want to know what's going on in a town, talk to one of the top hairdressers, or cosmetologists, they call them now. Well, Al Teitelbaum and his business of Furrier to the Stars, Furs by Teitelbaum, knew as much about Hollywood and its personalities and its gossip as probably Luella Parsons or Hedda Hopper or any other Hollywood entertainment writer. Because people, well, who are these furs being bought for a lot of the time, Al?
Well, a lot of times you had some of the motion picture heads of the studios and directors and producers, they were buying things for their girlfriends. And a lot of the things that they bought, they would charge to the pictures, you know? But I must say this about Howard Hughes, anything that he bought, he paid for himself. Not through all the years, not one thing that I sold him was ever charged to any motion picture.
Well, that's interesting. So Howard had a girlfriend or two that he bought a few furs for.
A girlfriend or two? I don't believe that there's any man that ever lived that had as many girlfriends that he was keeping at one time as Howard Hughes.
Howard was a prodigious fellow in many respects.
He was.
So when he wanted to buy a fur for a girlfriend, he would, well, how would this happen?
Well, what happened usually would be I would get a call, not from Howard Hughes, but from one of his men to take some furs up to, let's say, the Bel Air Hotel or the Beverly Hills or some other place.
To usually a hotel or often a hotel and would come by and pick up half a dozen furs?
God, I would bring them up to the hotel.
Oh, you'd take them up there?
I would take them up there.
I would think so. They're very valuable, yeah.
Yeah, I would take them up to the hotel. And Howard Hughes was never in the room with any of the girls. It would always be one of the people who worked for him.
Was Howard there ever in a different room or anything?
He was there, but I never saw him there.
Oh, really? Oh, this is fascinating. I'm going to stop this story right now because we have to do a break here in just a few seconds. But what we're going to do in our next hour with Al Teitelbaum is get his impressions on some of the people he knew and did work for and in some ways was a confidant of many people. Harry Cohen, Columbia, the Warner Brothers, Louis Mayer, and Howard Hughes, as we're talking about now, Daryl Zanuck. And we're going to talk about some of the great names in Hollywood history that Al knew and worked with. And there were more than a few of them. There were lots of them. One other quick question, Al, before we go on with the Howard Hughes story.
Yeah.
Did Orson Welles ever buy furs for anybody from you?
He did for Rita Hayworth.
I would have bought one for Rita Hayworth.
Well, he married her.
Yes, I know.
Well, I can tell you a funny story about a thing we made for Rita Hayworth, too.
Okay, we'll do that. As we continue in just a few minutes, I'm Jeff Rentz, Coast to Coast, and of course around the world as well. And we're talking with Al Teitelbaum, a very special program tonight.